Helena's new mayor today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Wilmot Collins fled Liberia more than two decades ago. He ended up in Helena, Montana, and yesterday, voters there chose him as their new mayor.
The people of Helena is telling the national media and the national scene that we're looking for good people. We're looking for people not because of where they're from or racial makeup. If he can move the city forward, we'll take him.
Also, the Trump administration issues new rules and warnings for Americans traveling to Cuba.
If the United States government is giving these warnings to Americans, why isn't every other country in Europe giving the same warnings? You proved to me that I shouldn't be there.
Plus, Uber meets its match in Beirut's old-style shared taxis. Those stories and much more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Every day, the show connects you to the larger world. That's just what we do. And today, we're seeing how even something as domestic as yesterday's local elections here in the U.S. are connected to places well beyond our borders. Like yesterday in Helena, the state of Montana elected its first black mayor. He is Wilmot Collins, a man who arrived in Helena 23 years ago as a refugee from Liberia. Collins is well-known and well-liked in his community.
Good to see you. Hi.
Hey, sir.
Someone we're so proud of, and just he and Maddie and their family could not be warmer, more genuine people of integrity. We're just always happy to see him, and he's so busy he doesn't get here often.
That was last year in Helena, before Collins started campaigning for mayor. He ran on a message of progress, advocating for refugee resettlement, something that has been hotly debated in Montana, and he succeeded in unseating the mayor of 16 years. Wilmot Collins, first of all, congratulations.
Thank you.
So you came to the U.S. from Liberia as a refugee in the 1990s. How roundabout was your path to Montana? How did you end up there?
You know, my path to Montana was not a roundabout way. We knew we wanted to come here. My wife was an exchange student, and she went to Helena High, and she lived with her host family here as an exchange student. So when we fled Liberia, we contacted her host family that were from Montana, Helena, and they were more than willing to start the process to get us over here.
So after a year in which the national tone coming out of Washington is not welcoming to immigrants, now you, originally from West Africa, you are elected mayor of Helena. What does that tell us? What is your take?
It tells me that the people of Helena, they're more advanced than the national. The people of Helena went through this election not thinking about the national scene. But with me coming in as a former refugee, it tells the national scene that this little town in Montana is telling you they're no different from us. He came here 23 years ago. He's made this community his community. He raised his kids here. And he's ready to give back to this community. And we accept that. That's what the community is saying.
So you've seen both the good and the bad in Helena in your time there. Not long after you arrived, I hear your home was vandalized. If you would, can you tell us about that and how it affected you and also how it affected your view of America?
It was a unique experience. My neighbor got up and saw it and went to my door and knocked on it. And I went outside and she said, "Did you see the nasty thing written on your wall?" And so I went outside and I saw it. It said, "KKK, go back to Africa." And I said, "Well, I have to go and call the police now." But the unique part about this story is my neighbor got the neighborhood together. And when I brought the police back, we saw them washing my wall down.
Wow.
That's what makes Helena what it is. That's why I'm proud to call this place my community. You hear about things like that all over this country, but you don't hear about the results. And that's what makes Helena different.
Why did you decide to run for mayor?
You know, before I decided, I spoke to voters. Before I decided, I knew that I wanted to do more than what I was doing. I knew I wanted to continue to serve this city, this state, this country. I'm winding down my military career. I got 7 more months and then I'll be done. And I know I will have the time and energy to put into serving this community. I had knocked doors before, but those doors that I knocked were not for me. They were for other people running. When I finally decided to knock for myself, it was nerve-wracking. And we knocked on hundreds of doors. Not once did we hear, "Get out of here." They were so polite. Even when they were not voting for you, they were still asking you questions. They were still being very polite. And that told me that, wow, they're more accepting than I thought. even though we disagree, we can still be friends.
I want to ask you this, too, because once Trump was elected last year, many people began saying, don't mope, get involved. This country is really going to change. It needs to start at the local level with locals getting elected to local office. Was that also a factor for you getting into this race?
Yes. And I heard it, too. If you can get involved, don't complain. And it was also a motivating factor. I have to get involved. This is my community. This is the community my family knows. This is the community my kids grew up in. And this community raised two beautiful kids. My son is a senior at the University of Montana. My daughter graduated. She's in the U.S. Navy. She's stationed in Miami. And I want to be able to tell this community, thank you. I want to be able to continue to serve.
That is Wilma Collins, who, as of last night, is the mayor-elect of Helena, Montana. Thank you very much, and congratulations again.
Thank you. I appreciate your call.
We had production help for that interview from reporter Ann Bailey. Another election that caught our eye was in the town of Edison, New Jersey, where racist mailers were sent out shortly before Election Day. They targeted two candidates of Asian descent who were running for the local school board. Craig McCarthy covered the race for NJ.com. So let's start with the mailers, Craig. What did they look like and what did they say?
So the mailers started coming in the mail last week on November 1st. They said, make Edison great again. They had two candidates on there, Jerry Shi and Falguni Patel. Headshots of them, and right below them there was a stamp with deport on it. And then the rest of the mailers said, stop. You know, Jerry Shi and Falguni Patel from taking over our school board. The Chinese and Indians are taking over our town. Chinese school, Indian school, cricket fields, enough is enough.
Wow. Who's behind these mailers?
So that's the question that nobody really knows at this point. Authorities are looking into whether or not any crimes or any election laws were violated in this. Under our state laws, under our election laws, any Board of Ed candidate who pays for anything at all has to be disclosed, and it has to be clearly marked. An independent group could have sent this out. Now, obviously, this is just a speculation from state officials who I was speaking with because they cannot comment specifically on this incident as to not appear biased in if they have to investigate it. But what they had told me at the state level is that if an independent group had sent this out, if they did not spend over $1,600, they did not have to report this.
Irony, though, the result of the school board election last night was what?
Jerry Shi and Falguni Patel won. They actually ran on a slate, which was called the Edison Unity Team. So the four candidates on that all won seats on the board.
So what's been the reaction? I mean, I know it's early hours still, but what's been the reaction in Edison?
I mean, they were expected to win. It wasn't an upset for them to win.
Is there now in Edison, or has there been a history of racism?
It's an interesting municipality in a sense. It's the fifth largest in the state. It has a very large foreign-born population. About 45% of the 102,000 people in the municipality are foreign-born. It has one of the largest populations of Asian and also just specifically an Indian population. Last year, if you remember, Trump actually held a rally there where it was attended by a lot of Bollywood celebrities.
I remember
and
that, yeah.
A lot of the people there were local Indians. And it's strange in Edison because Edison is actually primarily a Democratic town. There's very few Republicans in that town.
What do you think the mailers say about Edison, New Jersey? But also, what do you think they and the result of the election say about this time we're living through?
I mean, I can't really comment on what it really says about Edison. It's always been a very political town. But I guess the people who won is basically the cross-section of Edison at this point. You know, there's, you know, Jerry Shi is Chinese, Falguni Patel is Indian. So, I mean, it's a cross-section of the town at this point.
Craig McCarthy reports for NJ.com. Thanks very much, Craig.
Thank you, Marco.
This week, thousands of Nicaraguans living in the U.S. got some bad news. They found out their Temporary Protected Status, or TPS, will run out in a little over a year. The TPS program allows people from several countries to remain in the U.S. when those countries get shaken by things like armed conflict or natural disasters. But the Trump administration has begun to shut down parts of TPS. Now, the largest group under TPS, Salvadorans, worry they could be next. People like Carla Alvarado. She's a 29-year-old home health care nurse in Pennsylvania and a TPS recipient. Alvarado says that if she were to be deported back to El Salvador, she'd miss many of her patients, and they'd miss her too, including one little girl who Alvarado says changed her life.
She was 2 months old with a tracheostomy and an NG tube, a nasogastric tube for feeding. She had a lot of issues. So she's now 3. She's doing a little bit better, but I certainly would miss her in the sense that I still work with her 1-to-1. So I definitely would miss seeing her, you know, strive and do better. I think she would definitely miss me. It seems like she likes me a lot. I've known her for so long now. You know, and I have my elderly clients who have no family. So I do take a little extra step in stopping in a little bit more often. My clients, you know, she just celebrated her 92 birthday. She has absolutely no family besides our caregivers. So, you know, stop by and bring her flowers and balloons and things like that. I really do take pride in my work.
Sounds like some solid connections there. So, Carla, you came to the U.S. when you were 9. What did you know about your legal status?
I was really small at the time, but I know we crossed the border. So from the beginning, you're sneaking in, so it can't be good. And then in 2001, we were able to get TPS, which changed everything for us. You know, able to go to school, able to go to college and work legally. So, you know, I established myself now in my nursing degree, and it's a little scary to see if, you know, where we stand with that at the moment. And, you know, I am American. I don't know anything but the American culture.
So when did it really hit home for you how temporary protected status is?
I'm going to be very honest with that answer, and I'm going to say when Trump was elected. About a year ago now, when I woke up to the news that he was elected, I definitely felt unsafe. What's going to happen with us immigrants here, especially with the immigrants that are, you know, here working legally and trying to be good members of society?
You're married to a U.S. citizen. Shouldn't that shelter you from any immigration problems?
Well, we're starting the process. I just got married in September, so we're going to CARESEN, which is, you know, just a nonprofit organization in D.C. for people that have TPS from Central America.
Mm-hmm.
So that takes about a year and a half.
Right. And what's the timeline? Is a year and a half going to be enough?
I don't know. What scares me is that if after March, you know, if Trump doesn't allow us to renew it, I won't be able to work and I'm going to lose my position at work. I'm a nursing supervisor. I've been here for 3 years. And then, you know, I obviously don't want to leave my office. And I'm a little bit afraid too. I have a mortgage to pay. So, you know, I'm just a little bit scared that I won't be able to work while I'm doing this process after March. So,
yeah, and I suspect as a home healthcare nurse, a lot of people depend on you.
Yeah, I have a caseload of 60 clients right now. Definitely a strain on our relationship and our livelihood.
I want to ask you too, Carla, we're using your full name. How risky is it for you to even be talking to us?
You know, I'm not afraid. I really think we need to bring more attention to this. There's a lot of good people out here who are working hard, who are contributing. My brother as well, he was 4 when he came to the U.S. He's working hard. He works full time. He has 2 jobs. So we're all working. We are contributing to society. We're paying our taxes. We're doing everything by the law. I mean, if you look, I have a clean record. So does my brother. We never break the law because for us, it's scary since you know that you're not a citizen. You don't have the same privileges. So all we want to do is just get a piece of the dream. It's just the American dream. We want to have our white picket fence in our homes and continue with the families. So I'm not afraid to use my name. I also want to encourage other people that are here with TPS to study and go to school and better themselves. You know, I'm the first one in my family to go to college. So it seemed like it started a snowball. My brother went after me and I have 2 younger siblings also wanting to go to college. So we're going to make it happen.
That's great to hear. 29-year-old Carla Alvarado is a home healthcare nurse in Pennsylvania. She was born in El Salvador and has TPS, temporary protected status. I also want to thank Susan Farris of the Center for Public Integrity for helping us get in touch with Carla. You can read Susan's full story on the uncertainty facing immigrants when they lose their temporary protected status over at PRI.org. Carla, thanks so much for your time.
No, thank you so much.
Uber Schmuber. Beirut's traditional taxis are still going strong. That's up next here on The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. I'm sure I don't have to tell you that rideshare apps like Uber are crowding out traditional taxis all over the globe. But in Beirut, Lebanon, they're up against an especially stubborn competitor. The good old shared taxi is still the number one way to get around there. The World's Richard Hall rode along for a day to find out why.
There's a sound that's so prevalent on the streets of Beirut that locals hardly even hear it anymore.
We make the beep like that in the car because passengers, sometimes they walk. They don't notice that the taxi or the service are behind him. So we make the horn to get his attention.
This constant beeping is the sound of taxi drivers looking for business. Unlike in New York or London, where people may have to crane their neck looking for a taxi, Beirutis are fighting them off with a stick.
You hear that sound all over Beirut?
Sure.
Is it a special beep? Is it like just 1-2?
Like that.
That's it.
I'm riding along today with Gabriel Saad. He drives a beautiful 1980 Mercedes-Benz, with racing green front seats and royal blue leather in the back and on the dash. It's the quintessential Beirut taxi. The way taxis work here takes a little explaining. The vast majority of cabs are shared rides, essentially impromptu carpools, called a service. They cost $1 a trip. They work like this. Gabriel drives around looking for passengers. When he spots one, he pulls up alongside and a speedy negotiation takes place through the window. Once he has one passenger, he finds others heading in the same direction, and so on in a continuous loop.
I prefer to ask him exactly where you want to go. He tell me where. Okay, I said yes or no very quickly. This is the proper way for not losing time for the people behind me in their cars.
It's almost like a play. Everyone knows their roles, and it takes place thousands of times a day at the side of the road.
See? 5 seconds.
Not five.
Don't need 5 seconds. Sometimes somebody argues with you. Yeah. You need 7 seconds or 10 seconds if you ask him where exactly.
The service is the most convenient way to get around Beirut. It's also a great equalizer. The class divide doesn't exist in the back of this cab. Everyone pays the same price. Everyone squishes in the back when the cab is full. And everyone sits in the same traffic. Uber has made some headway here since launching in 2014. They now have more than 2,500 drivers here in Lebanon. But that's news to Gabriel. I have to explain to him what it is.
Is it found here in Lebanon?
Yeah, it's here now, yeah.
Maybe...
It's quite popular.
I don't know. I didn't hear about it. I told you, 80% of the Lebanese people, service. They don't pay taxi.
We pick up Garo and his daughter Marilyn in Bor Shamut, a neighborhood in the east of the city. He has his own car, but sometimes a service is necessary.
Once a month, I take her to the dentist. It's more cheaper. If I go with my own car, I'll pay parking 4,000, 5,000.
His daughter likes it too, for a different reason.
Because that's fast.
Usually, I talk to people. Some people don't like talking too much. I try to talk a little bit. If they talk to me, I continue talking to people about life, about problems in life, about the situation in Lebanon, about everything.
A little way down the road, we pick up Mary. She gets a service to and from work every day. She tries to avoid talking in the cab. But if the driver does start with her, it's always about the same thing.
About this problem of this country, about driver, about everything.
It's around 7 p.m. now and the service is full. Me, Gabrielle, Mary, another older woman and a man in his 20s, all with different destinations but heading in the same direction. My presence in the car has got the others talking among themselves. It's one of those nice service rides where people who wouldn't meet anywhere else are chatting along happily. For Gabrielle, it's the second shift of the day.
Usually I work from 7 morning till 12 noon time. I especially stop driving from 12 noon time till 7 or 7.30 at night. I rest at home. And then I go at night from 7.30 till 12 or 1 o'clock midnight. I work about 12 to 13 hours per day.
It turns out Gabriel was a college graduate who studied computer programming, but he couldn't find a job, so he followed his father into the taxi business. This beloved car was once his dad's.
So does it remind you of your dad when you're driving around in this car? Do you think of him?
Always. Always. I love this car. I can smell my dad's smell in this car. I love him very much. Because without this car, you didn't see me here, because he sent me to school and to the college from this car. He worked on this car, he paid for everything. That's why.
For the World, Richard Hall, in Beirut, Lebanon.
We have just enough time to get you up to speed on a story that's getting a lot of attention in Britain this week. It started with comments last week by the UK's Foreign Secretary, Boris Johnson. He was speaking to lawmakers about the case of Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe. She's a British citizen currently serving a 5-year prison sentence in Iran for allegedly plotting to overthrow the government there, a charge she denies. Zaghari Ratcliffe was arrested last year after going to Iran on vacation to visit her family. But last week, Boris Johnson appeared to say she was in Iran to train journalists. Her family and her employer have both denied that. But Iranian authorities seized on Johnson's false statement to suggest she could now face another 5 years in jail. Zaghari Ratcliffe's husband, Richard Ratcliffe, says it's all been a huge blow to his wife.
She's eligible for early release on the original charges in a couple of weeks' time. So there's a sort of hope that was coming in that she was going to be coming in. And then this happened. So that has really brought her down, brought all of us down.
Richard Ratcliffe asked Boris Johnson to retract his statement publicly, which the foreign secretary refused to do initially. Johnson has also called his mistake a simple slip of the tongue. That prompted a sharp rebuke from lawmaker Tulip Siddiq. She represents the district where the Ratcliffe family lives.
A slip of the tongue, in my books, is swearing in front of your child by a mistake. It's not condemning a British citizen to an extra 5 years in prison.
Boris Johnson has agreed to go before lawmakers again to clarify what he meant to say about Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe's detention.
The UK government has no doubt that she was on holiday in Iran when she was arrested last year, and that was the sole purpose of her visit. My point was that I disagreed with the Iranian view that training journalists was a crime. Not that I wanted to lend any credence to Iranian allegations that Mrs. Zaghari Ratcliffe had been engaged in such activity. I accept that my remarks could have been clearer in that respect, and I'm glad to provide this clarification.
That, however, was not enough for some of Johnson's critics, who've often demanded that Johnson be fired for his tendency to misspeak and offend.
How many more times does this need to happen? How many more times does the Foreign Secretary have to insult our international partners, damage our diplomatic relations, and now imperil the interests of British nationals abroad?
That's Labour Party Shadow Foreign Secretary Emily Thornberry.
How about the Foreign Secretary himself shows a bit of personal responsibility and admits that a job like this, where your words hold gravity and your actions have consequences, it is simply not the job for him.
Yeah. Last time I checked, though, Boris Johnson is still Britain's top diplomat. News headlines are up next here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. When someone told Maya Shiraroma that her favorite vegetable seed company would have to close its doors,
I told her, well, that's a huge shame because Kitazawa Seed Company is a huge part of Japanese-American history.
So she decided to do something about it. That story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. This week, we're remembering the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution, the upheaval that eventually led to the creation of the Soviet Union. The revolution changed so many things, of course, including art. Anna Weinstein has made it her job to show off the artistic legacy of the Russian Revolution. She's put together an exhibit of work by Jewish artists of the Russian and Soviet empires with themes of migration and memory. It's on view at the Museum of Russian Icons here in Massachusetts. Weinstein herself was born during the Soviet era in Leningrad, what today is St. Petersburg. I asked her what it was like to be a Jewish artist living in Russia before the revolution of 1917.
The vast majority of Jews were isolated to living in something called the Pale of Settlement, which is kind of spans across the western part of what would become the Soviet Union. Because Jews were largely excluded from major cities, they were excluded from the whole infrastructure of the art world.
The show features three sketches by L. Lisitsky. They're abstract if you kind of just glance at them, primary colors, geometric patterns against a white background. But then a second look kind of reveals really good draftsmanship and kind of a brain wired to science. Tell us about Lisitsky and how the revolution changed the life of this one artist.
So Lisitsky, very abstract, but both scientific but also spiritual and mystical, actually.
And what license did the revolution give to Lisitsky to do this?
Well, he had already been doing it. But what it did is give him a platform to bring this to much greater visibility, because it sort of turned upside down the art world hierarchies, and all the kind of much more traditional artists who had been at the top of that were suddenly no longer preeminent. And it shot him and people like him, like Malevich and Chagall, rather to the top of and receiving resources and attention.
The other item is not so much about an artist, but really about the item itself. It's a porcelain propaganda plate, really incredible because it is a dining plate, but on it there is this red army soldier dressed in teal stomping on the names of white army generals, the generals of the Tsarists. And the edge of the plate is painted cobalt blue and decorated in gold leaf, stars and letters. Who designed this plate and what's it saying?
So Mikhail Adamovich was an artist, one of a number of artists working at the former Imperial Porcelain Manufactory in St. Petersburg, which had been nationalized. The task for these artists was to proselytize the masses, to propagandize the masses. He's trying to kind of raise awareness of the things that are near and dear to the Bolshevik leadership's heart. And
Was it a kind of commemorative plate, or would people, like families, actually buy a dining set of like six of these and eat off them?
They wouldn't have been able to afford to, really. I mean, it's part of the idea was to make porcelain more accessible to the broader masses than it had been before. But in reality, nobody would have had a set of these. It was just a single commemorative plate, and there were quite a few made. So this would have been an object of pride in somebody's home and beauty.
I think some of these objects will really surprise people. If you had to generalize, how do you think Americans typically have thought about Soviet-era arts and objects?
I think there's sort of an instinctive feeling that it was sort of stuck in the past, but a lot of art was being made outside of that style with greater or lesser repercussions. Most importantly, most of the time, people who were working outside of that style weren't able to exhibit their works publicly, weren't able to share and sell their works, but they were still making works, as they call it, into the table or under the table. And so a lot of the works in this exhibition that date from Soviet times are not works that would have been seen, but that were continuing to be made, some of which are simply not buying into the kind of the propagandizing kind of mission, and some of which are really trying to undermine it.
Today, what is life like for Jewish artists in Russia, and what are they saying in their work?
On the whole, since 1991, the Russian artistic sphere has opened up enormously. And one of the biggest things is that, you know, artists can now travel freely, can exhibit around the world freely. And so the kind of bidirectional exchange with that artistic milieu has expanded enormously, and that has benefited Jewish artists and non-Jewish artists. The question is going to be what happens going forward. Will that freedom of movement, that freedom of exchange continue? And also, what will the policies of the government be about expression and the people it affects?
Anna Weinstein, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Anna Weinstein is a specialist on Russia's visual art and theater history. If liberty means anything at all, it means the right to tell people what they do not want to hear. Words written by George Orwell for a proposed preface to his novel Animal Farm. Yesterday, that line was unveiled on a wall outside the main offices of our partners at the BBC in London. And next to those words, a new statue of the man who also gave us 1984. Orwell once worked at the BBC World Service as a radio producer, even said it made him a sharper writer. Robert Coles is the author of George Orwell, English Rebel. First of all, Robert, what would Orwell have made of the BBC establishing a statue to him outside their office?
Well, I think he would have found it utterly, utterly, utterly. How many utterlies can I do?
Throw in one more.
Utterly astonishing. Or as BBC correspondents say, extraordinary.
And why?
I think he would have probably fallen to his knees laughing. I mean, this is a guy who did 2 years on about £12 a week, about $20. He thought he had no effect whatsoever in his time at the BBC, and he couldn't wait to get out and join a community of readers. That's what he was after, rather than a great black hole of listeners. So I think he would have been surprised.
Today is the one-year anniversary of our election here in the U.S., and after that vote, there were reports that sales of 1984 had spiked. Do you think Orwell is still relevant?
Yes, he is relevant. He always will be relevant as long as his past and our past are roughly similar, because he's such a great writer. And the diversity and range and originality of his essay writing in particular will always have an audience, I think, as long as his history and ours stay together.
So the Washington Post, you may or may not know, after Trump was elected and all the concern about what is real and fake news, which was a very Orwellian notion, the whole idea that propaganda could subsume real reporting, the Washington Post made their motto, and they put it outside their building, democracy dies in darkness. Do you think the BBC is also doubling down on what their mission is, the right to tell people what they do not want to hear?
Oh, yes. Well, the BBC is pretty good on that. Let's not kid ourselves. The BBC politically is a fairly left-wing, certainly liberal left organization. But at the same time, it's always been at arm's length from the state. So, yes, I do think it can speak truth to power. And, of course, Orwell was a great example of that. He was a man whose books were banned in British India, yet the British Broadcasting Corporation are taking him on and giving him a job.
What was Orwell's experience as a radio producer at the BBC? Did he
work like a dog? Never stopped working. I have the figures somewhere. I mean, we're talking about hundreds of programs. Great range, lots of work, teaching him, I think, to deliver his copy crisp and sharp and on time. Really making a journalist of him.
All right. If there's one thing of Orwell's that should be more widely read today, what do you suggest?
Great question. I love his essays on Dickens and Kipling just because they remind us that although he's a man of the left, he loved a rip-roaring populist, and he always had his ear to popular culture. And in that sense, if he was listening in to the Donald right now, I think he'd be asking himself, what can you say in 140 characters that's worth knowing? Shakespeare said brevity was the soul of wit, but it doesn't seem to me the president does wit.
Robert Coles is the author of George Orwell, English Rebel. Thanks very much for your thoughts, Robert.
Cheer, Marco. Very good.
There's been lots of Cuba news lately. The mysterious sonic attacks against U.S. diplomats there, for example. Damage caused by hurricanes. And today, new Trump administration rules for Americans traveling there. But if you want to know how Cubans are feeling right now, it can all be summed up by eggs.
One of the things that the last hurricane did was rip off the roofs of 100,000 hen houses across Cuba. All of the hens died so that there are basically no eggs now. However, if you know the right person, you can get them in front of the very elegant Nacional Hotel, which was the site of one of the sonic attacks. Apparently, I saw a Mercedes pull up and the trunk was popped open and 24 eggs were carefully taken out and carried into the hotel by a military officer. So that's something that Cubans certainly wish they had is eggs.
That's reporter Sally Jacobs. She's just returned to Boston from Cuba, and we wanted to know what she makes of these new regulations for U.S. travel to the island. The tourist industry had been preparing for a crackdown, but Jacobs says few people expected the new rules to bar Americans from setting foot in so many Cuban hotels and stores.
There was a list issued called the Cuba Restricted List that has 180 entities that American citizens cannot patronize. That includes about 83 hotels, including one of the newest, most elegant hotels in downtown Havana. And I think that set a number of people back. It was more than people expected.
Mm. Would you say this is a reversal of the thaw that Barack Obama started?
Well, it's certainly one of a number of pieces of a reversal. You know, if you step back and look at the big picture, there's a travel advisory out issued by State Department saying it's probably not safe to go there. The U.S. Embassy staff is down to a bare minimum, and now this comes on. You know, for a lot of Americans, that's too much. For a lot of Americans, it may be just easier to stay in Miami. If you do violate the terms of these 180 entities on the list, you can be subjected to fines or even criminal penalties. That's a pretty big disincentive.
So just clarify this. I mean, this is a list. So specific stores and hotels that Americans cannot go into, is that what they're saying?
Absolutely. One of them is the Abos Mundos, which is one of Ernest Hemingway's favorite hangouts. You cannot go there now and you might be subjected to a fine.
What is the rationale?
The notion is that most of these places are co-owned or run by the Cuban military or Cuban government. The idea is to cut off the source of funding to a government that the Trump administration opposes and ideally to funnel that money to other smaller entities. The truth is it hurts all Cubans really because it's jobs that everybody can have. You know, it's a whole economic system, but that's the theory.
This comes on the heels of this acoustic assault against staffers at the U.S. Embassy in Havana. What more do we know now about that whole incident? Well, incidents, right?
Right. There's not a lot more known now. The State Department has never said anything more about what the source is. Their posture has kind of been, until the Cuban government can guarantee the safety of Americans in Havana, we're not going to send people back. Really, there's been a stalemate. Nothing new has really happened.
So many Americans have continued to travel to Cuba. You were recently there and you spoke with one tour leader, Lee Gurnett, who is the owner of Modern Man Travel. He was staying at the Hotel Capri. That's one of the hotels where these sonic assaults reportedly happened. And Gurnett told you he had some curious preparations for his trip.
At our meet and greet party before we left, we created some aluminum foil hats that we all wore as a token gesture to deflect the sonic, whatever it was, the rays that were being directed at our hotels. We understand that that was really just kind of fake news. I mean, the hotel part, we don't really know that the embassy, I mean, we have to believe the news, I guess, that the embassy was in fact, you know, there were people there whose hearing was affected by that.
Yeah, tinfoil hat, a vital safety aid. But, I mean, a lot of people were taking and are taking these sonic assaults pretty seriously. What are the Cubans and tourists you spoke with thinking at this point about these sonic threats?
Right. There's a lot of speculation going on in the lobbies of hotels around Havana, and I would say there's probably three predominant theories. The first is that the Russians are behind this. They're trying to sabotage the U.S.-Cuba relationship in the months leading up to a change of guard in Havana. As you know, Raul Castro steps down in February. Two is that it's some kind of a spy game gone wrong. This scenario is that there was monitoring equipment in either the U.S. embassy or other embassies, and that it kind of went out of whack and hurt staffers on both sides. And the third is that it's nothing at all. Mm. There are some tourists that believe this was really totally fabricated by the Trump administration to reverse Obama's initiatives.
I was going to ask you, do you see any connection between these alleged sonic threats and the timing of these new rules and regulations on Cuba today?
In a background briefing by the White House, they said that there was no link at all, but certainly people speculate about that.
As for those sonic threats, I mean, you reached out to U.S. Embassy staffers who were evacuated from Havana, and many of them did not want to talk. But Colin Laverty, president of Cuba Educational Travel, says evacuated embassy staffers told him they wish the State Department had not evacuated them. Here's Laverty.
They felt strongly that they should be in Havana, and many of them said that they were more concerned about having to take their young children and change schools or have them miss their swimming lessons or other kind of life factors.
So, Sally Jacobs, you did speak with one former U.S. Embassy staffer in Havana. What was her perspective?
She, like many staffers, was very sorry to have been brought back. These people believe very strongly in the work they're doing. They've been doing it for a couple of years. They very clearly want to stay off the record, though. They feel that whatever they say is going to be used for political purposes. But she was also very clear that she and others do not agree with the Trump administration. But for the moment, they're going to keep quiet and hope they can go back to their jobs.
You've been to Cuba many times over the past few years. What is the mood right now?
You know, I've been there every year for the past 3 years, and I've been going there for over 20 total. But I really felt in my last visit a couple of weeks ago that the mood was really flattened. People are profoundly disappointed that the things fostered by the Obama administration are not happening. Little hotels on the beachfront, the Malecon, are not opening. A lot of people are really down. It's a time that feels kind of dark, and it feels like the gates are beginning to close.
Reporter Sally Jacobs, just back from Cuba. Thanks very much for coming to the studio.
Thank you.
Sally Jacobs' coverage of Cuba is supported by the Pulitzer Center for Crisis Reporting. Last night, President Trump was the guest of honor at a lavish state dinner in South Korea. Normally, the South Korean government would go to great lengths to avoid controversy at an event like that. But that's not what happened last night, because one of the guests at that dinner was a former comfort woman, a Korean woman who was kidnapped by the Japanese during World War II and forced into sexual slavery. Celeste Arrington is a professor at George Washington University who's written about this.
So her name was Lee Yong-soo, and she's been one of the most outspoken former comfort women or sex slaves. She testified in the U.S. House of Representatives subcommittee hearing, for example, in 2007, leading up to a major piece of legislation in the U.S., which called on the Japanese government to address this dark chapter of its past more forthrightly.
What do you think the message was that South Korea wanted to send by inviting Lee Yong-soo to this dinner?
So I suspect that there were two main audiences that the South Korean government was hoping to send a message to. One was to the U.S. and Japan, and that was not take South Korea for granted as the U.S., Japan, and South Korea are dealing with North Korea. There's been a lot of talk about how close Abe and Trump are, and there's a strong sense that the Korean Peninsula is kind of getting swept up by President Trump's rhetoric and U.S. policy and kind of walking over the interests of South Korea. And so this was a message of don't take us for granted. We have national interests, too. And then for domestic audiences, inviting Lee Jong-soo made the statement that President Moon has some control over South Korea's destiny, that President Moon, who's only been in office for several months, is going to stand up to Trump and Abe.
What has the Japanese position been on comfort women? I mean, have they shown any willingness to kind of address this openly, either with the Koreans or with the United States?
Yes, the Japanese government has addressed this in a variety of ways. There were statements by the Prime Minister of Japan acknowledging this past. And then most importantly, in December 2015, Japan and South Korea reached a major agreement on the comfort women issue. And the South Korean government set up a foundation which accepted a large chunk of money directly from the Japanese government for the first time, and has dispersed that money to surviving comfort women, who now number just over 30.
So last night at the dinner, Donald Trump reportedly hugged Lee Jong-soo. What message did that send to Korea and to Japan, if they were watching?
Yes, the Japanese government has said that it registered a complaint through diplomatic channels. But I think the hug from Trump sends a message that he acknowledges that this is a raw chapter in South Korean history. And when he was in Japan, he also met with the families of people who were kidnapped by North Korea. Both of these groups of victims are incredibly emotional issues in Japan and South Korea. And so it sends a powerful signal that he acknowledges an emotional and difficult issue in both countries' pasts.
Celeste Arrington, professor at George Washington University, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Finally today, the story of two Japanese-American families who have grown closer over time. From San Jose, California, here's KQED's Alyssa Jong Perry.
Nice to meet you.
Maya Shiroma is visiting Tom Kitazawa at his house in San Jose. It's the first time they've met. Tom is 87 years old and the last surviving son of the founder of Kitazawa Seed Company. In Tom's living room, Maya brings out the latest catalog from Kitazawa.
So, on the catalog, I wanted to ask you who is on the cover there?
It's an old photo with two men standing in a doorway of the seed store.
My dad would not be dressed up. He's a working kind of guy.
Yeah, but I do notice that this picture, he has a suit underneath the overalls. Yeah.
It's Tom's dad, Giju. He opened the business in 1917 after arriving from Japan. But before San Jose became the tech hub that it is now, it was a small farming community, perfect for a seed merchant. Tom remembers hanging out in the warehouse as a kid.
I used to play in the way, way back there because they used to have these 100-pound sacks of seeds.
Seeds for Asian vegetables, which were hard to find back then, like long, skinny Japanese eggplants, shiso leaves, which taste like a minty basil. Before the war, two-thirds of Japanese Americans living on the West Coast worked in agriculture or related businesses until they were incarcerated in camps after the attack on Pearl Harbor. Tom's family was sent to a camp in Wyoming. He was just a kid. They had to close the business. But after the war, the Kitazawas went back to San Jose.
Did your family, were they able to come back to their home, or did you lose your home?
Well, after the war, we had to spend about a year in a temporary quarters. Because
Tom says his dad was determined to reopen the seed company.
He immediately started doing those kinds of things that he felt needed to be done so far as reviving his seed business. Mm-hmm. You know, you're making contacts with the seed companies, his suppliers.
And that's where Maya comes in. She's 61 now, born after the war. Both sets of her grandparents had farms near Fresno. And like Tom's family, they were sent to camps.
Both families were fortunate to go back to it. Their neighbors took care of it. And so Kitazawa is how I learned how to garden.
She didn't know that the seed she planted would one day connect her family with Tom's. After Tom's father died in 1963, ownership of Kitazawa passed through the family and eventually on to Tom's sister. Then one day, Maya's father told her he hadn't received his regular delivery of seeds.
So he asked me if I would drive down to San Jose and go get his seeds and see what is happening.
That's how she found out Tom's sister was struggling to run the company on her own. Tom had a career as a computer programmer and wasn't interested in selling seeds.
And I asked her about what would happen to the business, and she says, well, we're just going to close the doors. And so then I told her, well, that's a huge shame because Kitazawa Seed Company is a huge part of Japanese-American history.
Maya bought the company in 2000 and moved it to Oakland. She created a website and expanded, offering new seeds from Vietnam, Thailand, and China. But she still measures and fills the seed packets the same way Tom did as a child, with metal scoops.
You know, like a dishpan or something like that, and pour some seeds in there, and we'd be assigned a certain size spoon or something like that.
Tom, it hasn't changed much today.
The company's survival story is unusual. Other Japanese Americans were able to restart businesses after the camps, but they were in the minority.
There are so many Japanese families that had to go through a very similar kind of thing, you know. Regardless of the hardships, we were very lucky.
As Maya gets ready to leave, Tom asks her to send some extra seed catalogs. He wants to save them for his young grandchildren, so they'll know their family's history. For The World, Alyssa Jung Perry, San Jose.
Well, that is a nice way to get over the hump on this Wednesday on The World. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Marco Werman. Tomorrow is Thursday. We're back with you then.
PRI, Public Radio International.